So it's also giving a short view of the main properties and the basic idea people have about gamma ray bursts. And then to concentrate most of the talk about the afterglow, which are making the headlines in the last 2 years. So these bursts were discovered in somewhere in the 60s and were published around this time with this satellite, which are the Vela satellite and satellite. For anyone who is not familiar with the bursts, they have variable durations. Some of them are very short, some of them are longer. They are distributed isotropically over the sky. This satellite, BASCII, which is the main instrument to detect the burst in the last decade, can find about one burst per day, about 200 a year. The peak energy of the photons is about 300 keV, that's why it's called the gamma ray burst. But it has a very long non-thermal spectrum, which is continuous for as high as you can measure, and quite often above 200 MeV and sometimes 10 GeV. And there is a short time scale of the variability, much shorter than the total duration of the burst. So we can have bursts of 100 seconds that have variability on time scale of less than a second. The first marginally strong evidence for the cosmological origin of these bursts was that their distribution is really isotropic, and the log n log s curve did not fit the s to the minus 3 halves. I'll not talk about this too much because today we have redshift of this burst, so it's no longer an important issue.
You don't have redshift on the very short.
Yeah, we have only redshift of something like 10 bursts.
Yeah, but the short ones are not to go
right.
So there is a possibility to still
there is a possibility that some of them, yeah. But at least a considerable fraction of them is cosmological.
One of the arguments against the cosmological hypothesis was the detection of cyclotron lines.
Right.
Were the cyclotron lines only found in the short burst, or were they also found in the long burst?
Or I'm not sure about that.
There's still no good understanding.
No, and there is also not very good understanding if the cyclotron lines are really there or not.
Well, even if the lines are real, there's still no good understanding.
Right, if the lines are real, yeah. There are some suggestions, but no real good understanding. Not of the theory of the lines, not of the existence of the lines.
Right,
from the observation.
Apparently, people don't care about it.
Not completely. You can find some papers here and there.
Here and there, but Vahe told me that there was some gamma ray burst conference and there was some new evidence for lines, etc. And you know, everybody apparently politically listened and then they went to the business.
I think it's a fair description, yeah. So how do we know how much energy is in this burst? We measure a flux here, which is some energy per square centimeter. We just multiply that by the distance squared, and we get an estimate of the energy. Before 2 years, more than 2 years ago, people did not know what d is, so they just put a cosmological distance of 10 to the 28 centimeters, and they got some estimates. Today, we see that the distance is actually bigger, because we have redshift to some of the bursts, and in some cases, we get energy as high as 10 to the 54 hertz, according to this equation, but with a d that is related to a measured redshift. So these are huge explosions. And the fact that there is so much energy immediately drives us into the compactness problem. If you just take so much energy, or even higher than that, and convert that to photons, which are the photons that you see according to the spectrum, you get that you have very high optical depth to this reaction, so that the photons will thermalize by creating pairs, and you will expect to see a thermal spectrum. And the optical depth to this reaction, just by counting the number of photons and using the volume compatible with the variability, is 10 to the 15, so it's really high. And you expect a thermal spectrum, and instead you have this very high energy table. The only solution that I think is widely acceptable is that there is a relativistic motion in the system. So this solves the compactness problem in two ways. First, it allows a bigger radius, still compatible with the variability of the time scale dt. Instead of the naive estimate of CdT, if the source expands in a relativistic Lorentz factor gamma, the radius is allowed to be considerably bigger. So if the radius is bigger, the density is smaller and the optical depth is lower. And second, the observed energy of the photon is divided by gamma to get the photon energy in the local frame. And if gamma is very high, it means that these 300 or MeV photons are very soft in the local frame and are unable to do pair creation. So the optical depth is reduced considerably by some high power of gamma, about 6. And you can see that Lorentz factor bigger than 100 can solve the compactness problem. So this is the main reason why people think that there is relativistic motion in gamma ray bursts.
I think it was Andrzej Jerzy some 20 years ago who was the first to talk about such things, right?
Well,
it
was so long time ago, I forgot about that.
Yeah, I think there is also a paper by Ruderman in 75.
Ruderman's argument is wrong. Ruderman actually has proven that bursts cannot be cosmological,
yeah,
even if they are culminated. Yeah. In a paper in Kikos. And then for many years people cite Ruderman saying that he has proven that bursts, you know, in any case.
But how do you prove the opposite?
Pardon?
You have proven the opposite.
Well, I mean, in one paper, I think I showed that this argument is wrong.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So, what's the
one in
there?
Well, I mean, I think that he did something wrong with the transformation.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah,
I mean, I didn't forget that this
is the Texas Conference.
Yeah, Texas Conference.
Yeah, yeah. I think there is some mistake,
I think. Yeah. So, there's a lot of history of this.
So,
but then it was well known that they cannot be cosmological for many other reasons, so nobody pay attention to that.
Okay, but now we know that at least most of them are cosmological. And to produce this relativistic motion and the burst from a... so people have this three-stage process in mind. The most interesting is probably number one, which is some compact source unknown, which releases more than 10 to the 52, sometimes maybe even 10 to the 54 hertz, on a short time scale. Then just under the pressure of this huge amount of energy, it expands in relativistic motion, and all the thermal energy becomes kinetic energy. And after, in a very big radius, this kinetic energy is converted again to radiation and creates the gamma ray burst. The sad thing about that is that the compact source itself is hidden. You don't see directly the compact source. You see only the outcome of this relativistic flow when its kinetic energy is transformed back to radiation.
Does stage three involve some kind of working surface against a medium?
Yeah, I'll talk about most of the talk will be stage three. So most of the relevance to this conference is probably stage one. And this is the stage I'll not talk about, but I saw that there was a talk by Peter Meserov that talked mostly on this stage. And most models today believe that some black hole is involved in this thing, but that's the only place you're going to hear black hole in this.
Do people honestly believe that there's as much as 10 to the 54 hertz ejected into these things?
I think most of them know, because they think some there's some
beaming. Okay.
But even with beaming, you get something like 10 to the 54.
The same good argument was used against cosmological gamma ray bursts. The energy is
well, that's not the only argument.
Therefore, it's
that's not the only argument.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this was a silly.
Right?
This was a silly.
I mean, actually, you could turn the argument around. It at least gave you an energy scale that was associated with some known sources and asteroids, in general, in contrast to halo.
Yeah, exactly. Halo is a very good.
Well, this is the answer to your question.
Right.
Page number three. How do you convert the kinetic energy of this relativistic flow into internal energy? There are two proposed mechanism, external shock or internal shock. External shock is something like supernova remnant, where you have a spherical shell, which is part of a big spherical shell, that collides with the surrounding, probably the interstellar medium or the progenitor wind or whatever. And it accelerates due to this acceleration, due to this interaction, and the kinetic energy transforms to internal energy, which can be radiated. Alternative mechanism that does not require any surrounding material is that the ejecta itself is made out of many pieces which move with different velocities. For example, this velocity is bigger than this velocity, so this shell will catch up with this shell, and when they will collide, some of their kinetic energy will be transferred to internal energy, and will be able to have some radiation. These are three temporal profiles of typical gamma ray bursts. And when I'm saying typical gamma ray bursts, it means that I went over the GRB catalog and picked up the most variable bursts that I could find. And you can see that the duration is about 100 seconds, but they have this short time scale variability that I mentioned, which is on scale of shorter than a second. The line here is so thick that... okay. So you can define the ratio between the total duration of the burst and the variability time scale as some measure of the variability, and you get that in many bursts it's more than 100.
But do you find millisecond variability in the long...
Millisecond is doubtful. first, because this instrument doesn't record the data on this time scale.
Yeah.
Only for the very first 64,000 photons.
Yes.
So you only have information on millisecond time scale on this. And then the statistics is bad, but people are saying that there is. That's the claim.
But I mean, it's going to come from the network and so on, the other detectors, like, you know, and so on, do they?
No, they don't do better than this.
So
it's the next generation of instruments, like SWIFT, that is going to do better than that.
But it's often said that they have millisecond variability.
Yeah, that's from the first 64,000 photons. So you see rise times shorter than a second, considerably short. This data is recorded on a 64 millisecond time scale.
Right.
So nothing below that, anything below that you don't know. Okay?
From this instrument, yeah.
Even this instrument has, from the very first beginning of the burst, some microsecond resolution, but only for 64,000 photons.
Yeah, okay.
So you have limited information here, which people, you see, but sometimes this, the beginning of the burst is a bad place to look. So, so people do some analysis, but it's not that obvious. But they claim that there is less than a millisecond, 0.2 millisecond in the best cases.
Okay. But that would just be the initial transient, that's the initial.
Yeah, you don't see the whole bit.
Yeah. But there is a group of very short bursts. That is like 10 milliseconds long. The Super Bowl burst was over, right?
Wait. The group of short bursts, the division to long bursts and short bursts is about bursts of 20 seconds are the long bursts and 0.1 seconds are the short bursts. Now, in the 0.1 second group, there is a tail that is going to 10 milliseconds, or there is one or two bursts, which are like that. It's not a big group.
It's like 10.
Maybe, okay.
But there's really no, for long period bursts, there's no evidence for anything in the body of the burst varying on much shorter time scale than a second.
Well, shorter than a second, yes, but not much shorter.
0.1 second, yes.
Oh, 0.1 second, so yeah, but not. Yeah. 10 milliseconds is hard to get from
right back, of course.
So the question, how can these flows produce this short time scale variability? You have this shell, this is part of the shell. The reason that I always plot this small region rather than the big one is that due to relativistic effect, the emission is beamed to a cone of size 1 over gamma. So if you have emission of radiation from here and the observer is located here, you'll never see anything coming from here because the whole emission is going to that direction. So you'll only see a region of size 1 over gamma out of the shell. And you have several timescales in this problem. One is the timescale that corresponds to the duration of time that the shell was emitting photons. Suppose it has some typical emission radius R and it emitted photons between R and 2R. You get some timescale, the lag between this one and this one of R over 2 gamma squared. You get also some delay between this one and this one, which is just the same thing. And you get another timescale from the width of the shell. So there are three timescales. Two of them happen to be the same. So to get this temporal variability, you have two possibilities, depending if you think that the burst itself is done by internal shocks or by external shocks. If you believe that this is done by internal shocks, then you have many shells, not only two, and the collision of each two shells is making a peak in the temporal profile, and what you see is this multiple shell structure. If you believe in external shocks, then you need the interstellar medium to be regular. And the collision of this shell with each of these interstellar medium clouds or whatever it is produces a peak. The advantage of this is that the source has to be very simple. You need only one explosion, and all the complexity is coming from the surrounding. So you don't need a complex source, you need one strong explosion. Here you need the source to create all these shells. So the source has to be complex. But I'll show that this has severe problems.
The source also has to last for the duration of the burst.
In this scenario?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because in this scenario, the duration of the burst is coming just from the distance between this and this. This pair and this pair. And this is... So this pair has to be emitted 100 seconds later than this pair.
Or even longer, right?
For long bursts.
Yeah.
Yeah, but long bursts are mostly not about 100 seconds. There is one or two.
Well, I thought there was one that lasted for a couple of hours.
But it's a really rare. Out of 2,000 bursts, it's one.
Okay.
So what is the problem with producing the variability in the external shock scenario? If you take this, if you want to produce some measure of the variability, I remind you that's the duration of the whole burst over the variability timescale, you can calculate from that the size of the emitting region, the size of these small globes. And they are not allowed to be too big, because if they are too big, each peak will be spread over a long timescale. You have the whole area that is observable by you, which is of order R square over gamma square, and you're also not allowed to put too many emitters, because if you have too many peaks, they will overlap. If you put more than n, this is n, if you put more than n emitters, each one of which dt, then they must overlap on a time scale of t. So you're not allowed to put more than this, and then you can calculate what's the active fraction of this shell. And you find out that the active fraction is less than 1 over n, and since n is bigger than 100, this is smaller than 1%. It means that only a small fraction of the shell can interact with anything if you want to produce this short time scale variability. So it's a huge efficiency problem, and this mechanism doesn't have any of this problem. The only problem with this mechanism is that we throw anything to the source. The source has to do anything, everything that we see, and then there is no problem if you get efficiency of 10% or even 40%, depending on the ratio of the velocities of the Lorentz factor of the ejector.
Frankly, what does efficiency mean?
The amount of kinetic energy that was converted to thermal energy.
Yeah,
and then you assume that the thermal
conversion can be offset.
The additional energy, the kinetic energy.
Sorry?
Well, doesn't talk about how you efficiently convert energy to kinetic energy.
Right. Okay. So it's actually an upper limit to the efficiency. Okay.
So it's kinetic in the thermal energy.
Yeah. In this scenario, what we have calculated is the size of these blocks. They have to be very small. If they are big, if they are of the same size as 1 over gamma, because of the equality of those two timescales, they will produce a signal which is comparable to the duration of the burst. So we must make them very small. And once you make them very small, they hit only a very small fraction of the shell. And you cannot put too many of them because the peak will overlap. So all these constraints give you an efficiency which is smaller than 1 over the, this n. And this n is 100, the efficiency of this kind of process must be less than 1%. So 99% of the shell is just not going to hit anything. So certainly the energy that is there is... Okay. An alternative, if you really want to overcome this problem, you have to make also holes on the shell so that where you didn't extract the energy, there is no energy. But no one knows how to do such a...
Okay. Okay, so that's saying that the source is driving everything, but it must be internal shocks.
Yeah, I think most of the community believes in that.
Can you rule out shrapnel?
What
shrapnel, where you've got individual tiny clouds?
In the shell itself or in the surrounding?
In the shell itself.
Moving shrapnels.
Yeah, so that's what they said. That's the way to overcome that.
I mean, you were talking about homogeneity in the surrounding medium.
Right. And if you want to do, if you want
opposite.
To put these clouds on the shell itself is made of slow blocks, you can do that. But think of the sizes. This is 1 over gamma. You should do variability in the shell on scales of 1 over gamma over 100.
I understand, but can...
Any reasonable hydrodynamic, these clouds that you will put here will spread.
Well, I'm just saying, let's suppose that they were, they didn't.
Yeah, then it's okay.
Then I think you're allowed to, you know, you could have one sort of narrow, thin shell composed of shrapnel.
Right, but most of the shell must be empty. 99% of the shell must be empty.
Right. I'm just saying, the relatively low spinning factor and well, I don't really think it's haphydrodynamically being confined by ram pressure.
Yeah, but each cloud should be smaller than 1 over gamma by a factor of 100. Which is how
I think. I think that's required, yes. I think you probably would require that. But can you rule that out? I know what I'm asking.
Is that
distinguishable from internal shocks?
Yeah, that's distinguishable from internal shocks, and I cannot rule that out.
Okay.
If anyone can produce that, that's
Isn't
the efficiency for a little bullet shrapnel piece really, really high? Like, incredibly high? You have to produce the whole luminosity from a few little...
Yes.
So instead of having a shell with a huge luminosity and using a little bit, now you're putting all the luminosity in a few little...
At a given time,
how to combine the energy to this?
Well, it would give you the I mean, the point is to get the variability. If you just had a homogeneous shell, that wouldn't vary.
Yeah, but I mean there is shrapnel in nuclear blasts. And it does produce some variation in the velocity, but not. It's hardly the.
Well, it's not relativistic. The point is, relativity gives you a. Well, it's classified.
Yeah,
I think it's not relativistic. it's a wonderful amplifier. Relativistic motion. You get gamma to the 3+ alpha and so on. So a little tweaking of the speed or the direction gives you a huge increase. So
if you want to get efficiency back, you must make the rest of the shell empty. So if there is energy there,
you restore putting back right.
Right. Yes. So the whole GLB stuff went into the headlines around this day when people began to find some non-GLB stuff around the GLB or after the GLB. And this is what people call afterglow. Some observations or how is it done? There is a satellite called Deposat that can just localize the burst quite accurately, much more accurately than Batsy. This is a schematic diagram, it's actually a real diagram. This is the error box of Batsy, the blue thing. So this is a few degrees, this is scaling degrees. And this is the error box of, this is just a square in here, increased to this size, and this is the error box of Deposat. So this is a few arc minutes relative to few degrees that Deposat can do relative to Batsy. So that's the only advantage of Deposat. It can localize the burst into a few degrees, and few arcminutes relative to few degrees. And this changes the whole game, that people can turn optical telescope, radio telescope, and search the error box for any valuable thing.
How is it done? How does it
How does the Betasax work? It's a mask with X-ray. Okay. Shadow mask.
And what is the field of view of Betasax?
One of the, it's 40 by 40 degrees. Two cameras, each one 40 by 40 degrees. Although it covers one over 20 of the sky. Mm-hmm. So this is the disadvantage of this guy. Since Bucky covers almost the whole sky, this is about 20 times less efficient. So this Bucky finds 200 a year, this finds 10 a year. So that's why it's all going a little bit slow. If you should replace the tracks or co op with the tracks and find about 50 a year, according to optimistic estimates.
Yes, okay.
And another disadvantage of this guy is that it can transmit the data to Earth only once in orbit. So you have to wait, and you cannot look at the position of the burst right at the moment that the burst is happening. While Bassi transmits the data immediately, in a few seconds, 5 seconds, the data is already on Earth and people can turn telescope, but with this huge error, it's not so useful. Except of one event that they're not to be useful.
So do you know whether you're going to get For a Bassi burst, do you know whether you're going to get the Betasax observation later on?
You know, if you're going to get.
Yes.
Yeah, if you're communicating with the Betasax people, they know where the white.
They know where they're pointing. Yeah, so they know they would have seen that. So.
All right. What help does you get from that?
Well, you can still turn the BLA to look to make a map. Observe quickly after the.
But you can't
the gamma ray field, and then. And then you have a wide field map, and then the Betasax would narrow down the area.
But you need a map of 2 degrees. And then the sensitivity will be the sources, the radio sources that are found in the atmosphere are millijansky, less than a millijansky, 100 microjansky to millijansky sources. With a 1 degree map, you can have a grand telescope for this. So, this is the first one that was discovered. Actually, this is a picture some 7 months, 6 months or 7 months after the burst. You can see that the HST image, that's an increase of this inner area. And you can see some host galaxy. Maybe you can see some host galaxy. And this is the afterglow. This single pixel thing is the afterglow, so it is not resolved by HST, of course. And for this specific burst, you need measurements of the HST because quite early on, the host galaxy becomes brighter than the afterglow. So to resolve the afterglow from the host galaxy, you need HST. And we have observation from HST of this very first afterglow going on for more than a year. And the optical flux decays very nicely like a powder. One of the most important outcomes of this development is detection of redshift. That's the very first redshift detection. It's not in the first burst, but it's in 0508. We also have these complicated names of MKR, 5, and these numbers. So. but they all begin with GLP. And the numbers there are the year, month, and day. And there is a list of redshifts by now. Yeah, by now we have another redshift, same as this.
That's
what I said, there is another one.
When you get confused, it's going to happen.
What? It's supernova.
Oh, yeah, that's the
why the field. This field comes to an end.
Yeah,
it was what we call it 008.
Yep.
Which is the super, but this is what the sickest people in some direction.
There are also radio afterglows. Again, of this very famous burst. This burst was actually quite weak GLB, but it had a quite strong afterglow. So it's a very famous burst. It's the second afterglow ever discovered. And this is the radio emission from that burst in two frequencies. And you can see this huge variability, which is not a variability of the source, it's a scintillation. Which is decaying in time, as you can judge from this figure. And from the time that the scintillation decayed, people estimated the size of the source when the scintillation moved from diffractive scintillation to refractive scintillation. And the estimate was 10 to the 17, just compatible with the expansion rate that you expect from this model.
Because most of its redshifts are the redshifts of the galaxy, not of the galaxy.
Yeah, so let me go back to this list.
I think one or two.
Two. Yeah. This redshift of the galaxy, that was measured about 2 years after the burst, because the galaxy is very faint. That's the galaxy where I showed the picture of HST. The galaxy is faint and it starts to make this redshift. This one was measured within the afterglow, a few days after the burst. And so this is absorption line redshift, meaning that the redshift of the burst is greater or equal to that. Yeah. But then they found the host galaxy with the same redshift. And the host galaxy is so small that it's hard to imagine that it's by chance going on the line of sight. This one is the redshift of the galaxy, not of the burst. This one is the galaxy also. And this one is absorption line. So this and these are very secure.
I got an email this morning from Lars Bilston, who said that he's at this meeting in Crete, and I don't know whether it's all there. He said there was some X-ray data that showed possibly redshifted lines in the X-ray spectroscopy. Do you know anything about that? That would be.
Which is this that was asked?
I don't know. He wasn't specific. He just said.
There was something on Astro PH, so you could find it there. I didn't read it when, because it said possible, so.
Well, Matthew was the word he used, but.
Yeah. Well, there was one we saw with XTE where it looked like there might have been a 5 kV feature that you would expect it to be about, 6 or 6.5.
Yes. Yeah.
But the statistics were very uncertain.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. So this is the optical light of the decay for the Paolo. This is the second one. This is 0508. And we have now even longer time measurement. Decay like a nice Paolo. So what does the theory say about this burst? So before we said 3 stages, now we say 4 stages. First stages are the same, except that number 3, we know that the radiation is due to internal shocks. This is the popular view. And this produces the gamma ray burst itself. But after that, there is an afterglow by external shocks, because after you have all the internal shocks, you still have a relativistic motion of a shell, which is a combination of all the small shells that interacted. And this still will interact with the surrounding interstellar medium, and will decelerate by external shocks. And this deceleration takes a long while until the whole thing becomes non-relativistic, and actually then it goes to the stable Taylor phase. So this is what people believe this is the source of the afterglow, and I think that's also agreed. So what is the step path that you expect from these relativistic shocks? There are two types of spectra, either this one or that one. Let me spend a little time explaining this one. The assumption that goes into this kind of spectra are really simple. It's really the simplest model that one can imagine. There is a power law of electrons with a minimal cutoff, which is given by the temperature of the plasma, or by equipartition of electrons with protons. And this power law is characterized by the number of electrons per unit Lorentz factor is going to down to the minus p, the standard notation. And then it produces synchrotron radiation in a given magnetic field, and this is this law. So n to the minus p minus 1 divided by 2. Now if you go to high enough Lorentz factor of the electrons, or to high enough observed frequency, which is the same, you get that the cooling time of the electron is much shorter than the duration that the system exists, so that these electrons cool and they do not stay at the system for a long enough time. That's why they give less radiation by half power of frequency or one power of the Lorentz factor. So you get this break and this is called the cooling plate. This point is just the typical frequency of the typical electron, the minimal electron in that parallel distribution, and below that you simply have the low energy payload synchrotron radiation. This is moved to the cell. At very low frequencies, you have self-absorption, which gives you this new square. The reason that this is new square over here rather than the more famous new to the 2.5 is that you obtain new square while when all the electrons that are radiating have typical frequencies higher than the frequencies that are self-absorbed. You get 2.5 if this parallel would have continued all the way down here. Okay, so this is the this spectra, and you can have a similar version of this spectra if the cooling frequency becomes to be lower than the minimal frequency, so that all the electrons can cool. But you get these two kinds of spectra. And in order to estimate these breakpoints, you need to know the size of the source, the Lorentz factor in which it moves, and the magnetic field, and the minimal electron energy. And for that, you do the simplest assumption again is you take equipartition for the minimal electron, equipartition or fraction of equipartition, a constant fraction of equipartition to the magnetic field, and you solve some hydrodynamic evolution to find the size of the source, and you have these three breakpoints. So you can find out how these breakpoints evolve in time. And once you evolve this spectra in time, you can get a light curve. So we have the previous broken parallel spectra just moving to lower and lower frequencies, and if you observe in a given frequency, before the peak has arrived to your frequency, you see a rising spectrum, and once the peak crosses your frequency, the arising flux, and then the flux begins to decrease. This is this rise and this decrease. And there is a relation between the rate of this decline and the spectral rate. Of this, because these, the decrease of the breaking point is given only by the hydrodynamics. Once you have this slope, which is given by the electron parallel, you can calculate the temporal decay. So these two are related. And that's what many people are doing now when they measure afterglow parameters. They go and check what the spectrum is, they go and check what the temporal decay is, and they see if it fits this model or not. And it usually does.
What kind of size of gamma bin do you get? The lowest electron?
Yeah, so it's a fraction of equipartition. And the fraction is found to be quite high, more than 10%, something like half. So the Lorentz factor of the motion after, it depends on time. It's about 5 after a day, and it decays like t to the minus 3/8. Okay. And if that's the motion, that's the bulk Lorentz factor, that's also the thermal Lorentz factor of the proton, and the thermal Lorentz factor of the electron is about 1,000 times higher. So you get something like 5,000 after 1 day, and then it decays by t to minus 3. The thing that I like about this afterglow thing is that it has a very simple theory. Simple theory, at least in comparison to the internal shock things, when you have so many parameters, the width of the shell, the distance between them, and everything is done by the source, you don't know anything about that. But the afterglow theory is very simple, because it is characterized only by very few parameters. These. The total energy in the burst, the surrounding density, this parallel of the electrons, and the fraction of energy that is going to electrons in the magnetic field. Given that, you can calculate the whole spectra and light curve, and it depends on the time. You have some blast wave going into the interstellar medium, and Roger has written this paper in 76 describing the profiles behind that, and you can use that to do all the emission calculations, assuming this simple equipartition of electron and magnetic field. I'm oversimplifying things because I'm saying equipartition and no one knows how this equipartition is going to be done behind it, so how the magnetic field is going to get to these huge values of equipartition. But the observation seems to require that.
Can,
We've had a discussion before, so this initiated a little bit of a debate about this, because I'm still a bit sceptical that the afterglows come from the outer shocks. Partly because you're sceptical that you build up the field this quickly of a precision value.
What's the alternative?
I think the alternative is that it's still coming from, say, contact discontinuities and so on. If you take the analogy with supernova remnant, with sort of non-relativistic supernova remnants, and in the outer stages, it should be non-relativistic.
Relativistic after about a month or...
Yeah, but you're observing these things for nearly a year in 508. If you ask about observations of galactic supernova remnants, what you actually see, as I understand it, is the synchrotron emission coming from the sort of interaction between the ejector and the swept up interstellar medium.
Right.
You rarely, if ever, see the external shock. Which is telling you that the place where you get the field wound up and the it is happening, say Pathé is a sort of splendid example. It's that sort of jump that the contact discontinuity is.
So this is the surrounding, this is the outside, and this is the ejector.
Yes.
And this is a shock going into the ejector, which is called the reverse shock. And this is a shock going into the surrounding.
Yes.
But the point is that all of this stuff in the gamma reverse scenario, because the ejector itself is so thin, lasts for a very short time. And the reverse shock causes that within the time scale of 100 seconds or so. And then all that cools adiabatically. And you can estimate the evolution of the emission from that. And I'll describe that later. It gives something that decays very fast. You really need this very long ejector tail to make this last a long time.
Right, but that's a sort of model-dependent thing. It depends on the nature of the explosion and how long it goes on for and so on.
Right, that's cool. But then how do you get such a short gamma ray burst if the ejector is so much spread? You can work it out. Can be done, yeah.
I think it could be done, but I guess I still have this fundamental problem that you're looking at something, although it's not a supernova remnant, but the late 0508 is the best example. It's going on for nearly a year.
Right.
Surely you see no sign of it undergoing a mildly relativistic transition.
Yeah, but when you calculate the transition that you expect, it doesn't happen to be that sharp. And the L bars on the late time scale,
yeah,
when you expect that transition, I think they allow you that condition.
Well, even a bit at late times, it's traveling at the speeds that are sub-relativistic.
Yeah, even then, you can calculate
a very long way away from it.
And you'll see this is a relativistic prediction, and the non-relativistic prediction will have some breakpoint after a few months, which is not much below the relativistic one. At least not at the high frequency where you observe.
It need not be, I agree.
I think the orbitals here are big enough that you can observe.
Yeah, but it's not a long way away from a young supernova remnant, I would say.
Well, it's still moving, even in this space, it's still moving in a considerable fraction of speed, but
Right, but
it's
more than 10,000 kilometers a second, but not...
Yeah, right.
But not a lot, it's the same sort of energy as, it's maybe 30,000 kilometers a second at the end.
Oh, no, it's more than that. I think. After a year?
Must be C by 10.
No, I think it's more. Somewhere in between C by 10 and C by
3. Well, yeah. And then we go to C minus 3 half, because Well, anyway, I don't know if this is the latest, but it's not a far, at the very end, it's not a long way away from a young supernova remnant.
That's cool. Except that it is located so far that it's hard to detect, and the orbit can be. Okay. I didn't talk about this. This is just a comparison in, again, the same 0508 of the observed data points and the afterglow model that we showed you before. And you can see that the fit is quite nice. Some of it only in upper limits, Here there is actually a detection. You can see it's sort of a square coming up. And it's not great, but it's nice. When I say it's not great, I don't mean that it doesn't fit. I just mean that we don't really have this one, and we want to have one. Well, observation will get better. Maybe also the theory when it doesn't fit. You can do some sort of more detailed calculation rather than just scaling those that I do before that make this bulk and hollow. And you can calculate the emission from the whole fireball. And when you do this, and how much emission comes from each part of it, and when you do that, you can get nice pictures. This should be the image of this fireball, if you can resolve it. I don't think you can, but the size of that, after a reasonable time scale, let's say a few weeks, when it's bright enough, is something like a few micro-arc seconds. Yeah, maybe in the future someone will be able to produce this nice thing, and the difference between that is just the different regimes that you look in this broken parallel thing. This at high frequency, it looks like a ring, a very thin ring, and at low frequency, it looks like a very flat disk.
Why do you have this limb brightening?
You can see this is the surface of equal arrival time to the observer. Okay? Photon that was emitted over here, that was photon that was, this is the source. The observer is here. And imagine a photon that was emitted at this point. It was emitted and arrived to the observer at a certain time. If on the same time a photon was emitted over here, it was reaching the observer later because of this cosine theta thing. So this photon that was emitted here was will arrive to the observer later because it is farther away from the observer. So if you want a photon off the line of sight to arrive to the observer at the same time, you must take it in an earlier value. That's why you have this shape. So this is the shape of equal arrival time. So a photon that was emitted here will arrive with a photon that will arrive at the same time with a photon that was emitted over here. Okay? But at this time, the radius of the shot is smaller, and the Lorentz factor there is higher, and all the emission properties are stronger there. Okay? So you get that these images, for example this one, though that it is observed at the same time, it was not emitted at the same time. And the photons that were emitted over here were emitted earlier, but out of the line of sight. So it takes them more time to arrive, so they arrive simultaneously with the photon that was emitted later over here. And since they, in the high frequencies the emission decays in time, you get that you get this limb brightening. But in low frequencies the emission rises in time. That's why you get this more flat. This qualitative reduction is better. Another nice thing that you can do when you have these observed spectra, observed power, you can compare the breakpoints that you infer from the observation with the theory, and you can get the few parameters that are in these models, since there are not too many. So actually you observe this slope, which directly gives you P, and you observe three breakpoints and one normalization of the whole thing, so you have four observations and a slope. The slope gives you P directly, and then four observations give you the rest of the four free parameters.
All this is assuming that P is independent of the energy of the
frequency
you're looking at.
Right.
But injection P.
Right. So you assume that the injection is a power law, that's what you're saying, and not something else. And the fact that the flux decays so nicely as a power law supports that. Otherwise, you should have seen different decay rates of the flux rather than a power law. If the accuracy is good enough to say that only or weakly, we'll have to see. You get that the magnetic field is sort of a little bit less than equipartition, maybe 1%. The electron fraction is almost equipartition, or actually equipartition. The density is reasonable for the interstellar medium. And another nice thing is that the energy that you infer, this inferred energy just from this diagram, is comparable to the energy that you know that must be there from the gamma ray burst itself. So it all comes out to be, all the parameters I would say comes to be pretty reasonable. You can find some other people doing the same thing and getting, like these guys, getting some different numerical values for these strings, because they have a little bit numerically different estimate of these breakpoints. But that's only a numerical thing, it's not a fundamental point. How much time do I still have?
It's almost when people get bored, there is a few jokes at night.
Okay.
Up to you.
The last part is the reasonable test, it's a large epsilon E. Like
what?
Your epsilon E efficiency for what? What point five is that?
Well, you know, the basic assumption of this model is a fraction of equipartition. Yeah. If this fraction becomes very small, then it would be unreasonable to assume that it's constant, for example. So as long as it's roughly on the order of unity, I would say that it's reasonable. If I get 10 to the minus 6, it's not in the spirit of the model. If I get 10 to the minus 2 for the magnetic field, then Roger will ask, how did you get such a big magnetic field? That would be a fundamental question. But it's in the spirit of the model that assumes a reasonable fraction of the position.
How much time do you want? How much time do you need or you want?
Well, I can do it shorter or longer, depending on how much time do I have. And
it depends how much, an hour, 2 hours, 15 minutes, what are the orders of magnitude? Do you want to show everything?
It's more than
half.
Yeah. I did about half, but I can make it shorter or longer. I have quite different topics
where
I can speak
something. Yeah, I mean, half could be a bit, but if this half, another hour would probably be too long.
Well, then
especially
now.
For
too relativistically, so it could be
good. Yeah, 20 minutes.
I'll run around the
20 minutes.
Okay, 20 minutes is good. So I'll discuss now a few bursts that were of interest. This one, at the end of the first year of afterglow observation, was just interesting because of the very high redshift that it was observed at, again, the redshift of the galaxy. This one was the first evidence of a huge energy, larger than people thought before. And as Roger said, this is one of the simulations for people to say jets. Okay. I think this is gone by now.
Oh, Proctor, how long ago is
that? Well, I'm not sure about that. So, yeah. what about jets? Let's assume that the emission is not spherical. It's confined to a jet of opening angle theta, much smaller than radium and so. We won't know. The point is that during the gamma ray burst itself, we won't know, because we only see an emission coming from a cone, a small cone of size 1 over gamma. So if the observer is here, or somewhere in here, and the emission is confined to an opening angle theta, you anyway don't see the emission that should have come from here or from here, and you think that the whole evolution is spherical. The afterglow model will be true, any calculation you do for the gamma ray burst model will be true, except that the real energy in the system is smaller than what you call the energy by factor of theta squared. So you can really save the energy budget without doing anything to the calculations. But when the whole thing decelerates, gamma is getting smaller and smaller, so this thing grows. And at a certain time, it will grow to be bigger than the opening angle of the jet. So you will see that you are missing this part. And you accept some deviation from that simple theory. At the same time, the jet will begin to spread. The jet itself cannot spread on earlier time because it doesn't have enough time in its local frame. Even if it spreads sideways on the velocity of light and the speed of light, then the spreading will be much smaller than the opening angle as long as 1 over gamma is smaller than theta. So at the transition from this situation to this situation, two things happen simultaneously, or more or less simultaneously. One, you begin to see that the sides are missing. Second, the jet itself begins to spread and changes the dynamics of the evolution. What you expect in this kind of thing is a break. If the lighter looks like that, you expect a break in that lighter and this is about e to the minus 1, and this is about e to the minus 2.5. Now, the duration of that in which these breaks occur is not easy to calculate, especially not in this very simplified model that I'm discussing here. In this model, it's just a point break. People claim to do some more detailed thing, and they show see that this break is really smooth and takes a long time, but their models are not complete yet, so they still have some effect that they didn't include there, so you don't know where it's going to end.
Well, I think if Marek were here, he would have said that it could not be. I think if I remember his talk correctly,
it could be
very, very rough. Yeah.
I read his paper, yeah. He calculated a more detailed model. More detailed meaning not only these asymptotic parallels,
yeah,
but the whole transition. But the way he does the calculation is not complete, and he knows that. So, when you do the complete calculation, it can be even smoother than he says, or shorter than he says.
I don't know. You speak for himself. I haven't read the paper, so I don't know. He was quite emphatic when he...
Yes, he said it.
I think he was quite emphatic when he was here, but it was unlikely to be sharper.
Yeah, I think that's the spirit of the whole paper, but he does have a paragraph there saying that some effects are not included, and you need a full calculation. Either you need 2D simulation or the self-similar solution I was talking about.
Yeah,
about.
Sure.
The entropy says it will get smoother, though.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Well, it depends. For each effect, you can see which direction that it goes. A second thing that is of great interest is the how much of the whole fireball model we have really constrained. We know that the initial launch factor must be bigger than 100 to solve the compactness problem within the Gunner reverse itself. But all these afterglow observations, they observe only late afterglow, when late means few hours, when the launch factor is already less than 10. So we didn't consider that, at least not at this part of the talk yet. So we don't know how big is the Lorentz factor. We know it's bigger than 100, but is it 1,000, is it 10,000, is it 10 to the 5? And this will tell us how clean is the environment where the explosion goes. If it's a huge Lorentz factor, it must be very clean. If it's only 100, it has to be also very clean, but we call it moderately clean. We also don't have a direct evidence for internal or external shocks. We have only this efficiency argument, and we want more. So, when you want more, you're trying to see which predictions can you make that will solve these ambiguities. One is the rise of the very early afterglow. This is the dashed line is the afterglow that you expect, meaning that you follow the way that the initial interaction between a shell and the interstellar medium begins. This is the self-similar part that is producing the spectra and light curve. But you want to do the initial stage of that. And then you can ask yourself what is the relation between that and the GRB itself. And you find that for short bursts, if the burst lasts for less than a second or so, you should be able to see a separation between the GRB and the afterglow, if the GRB is by internal shocks and the afterglow is by external shocks. If the GRB itself is long, there is no separation. And I think that most of the cases that we've seen look like that. That there is a GRB made by internal shocks producing something which is variable, and somewhere over that you have the rise of the afterglow and then the decay. So you don't see the transition between the afterglow and the burst. But if we will be able to observe shorter bursts, we should be able to observe this transition, and we have a prediction of how this rise should behave. So when this will be detected, we will know that this is the afterglow, because we have the spectrum and the light curve of this rising part. For the GRB, it is hard to predict, because it has all these internal shocks with too many degrees of freedom, but it's easier for the afterglow. One outcome of these early interaction calculation is optical emission. As you see in here, there is a reverse of going back into the shell and a forward shell going into the interstellar medium. This produces all the stuff that I talked before, but this will also have some emission. Now, since this material is much denser than this material, and there is pressure equality between these two areas, the temperature here is much lower than the temperature in here, meaning that the frequencies of emission in here are much lower, and can be in the optical. If you take just a comparable amount of energy to the gamma ray burst and put it in optical in that redshift, you will get that you can get a signal of 6 magnitude. If you do a more realistic calculation, saying that this doesn't peak exactly at the optical, but it peaks at UV and it doesn't cool efficiency because the efficiency because the temperature is lower, you can get a more realistic estimate, and you can see this is magnitude as function of the initial Lorentz factor, which is a basic unknown in the whole stuff. What magnitude you can expect, and you can see some. It must be, for any reasonable value of the initial Lorentz factor, it must be bigger than a 14th magnitude signal. And this was indeed detected for 0123 for that nice burst that we'll discuss in a second, and a signal of 9th magnitude was seen. So the initial Lorentz factor is something like a few hundred according to this. So what was so exciting about this burst? I think it's the burst with most papers.
Is it interesting or exciting?
It should be exciting. It was very bright. If you just take the flux and multiply by 4 pi d squared, you get 3 times 10 to the 54 Hz. It was observed in all the wavelengths, which everyone likes, of course. It had the absorption line redshift, which is a very secure redshift. It had an host galaxy with the same redshift, which is good. It had new ingredients to all previous bursts, which is prompt optical observation of visible magnitude 9. This observation was done using BATSI. So even though BATSI orbox is large, there are some experiments like LOTIS, OTSI, and TAO in France that can observe this large field of view, or most of this large field of view, in a few seconds. And they really observe this place 20 seconds after the burst, after the beginning of the burst. So they have observations simultaneous with the burst itself, optical observation. And they found this, which is just the emission from the reverse shock. They found a radio flare, which is a radio signal that doesn't last for months like the previous one, but just rises on a time scale of day and decays quickly. And then they saw a break in the optical light curve, which is this jet thing that people are speculating about. This is the gamma ray emission from that nice burst, and this is the time where we have optical emission. So just at the peak of the GLB emission, we have optical observation, and you can see that the ratio between gamma rays and optical light is very non-uniform, suggesting that it is not the same mechanism producing the two. So this is just that the gamma ray burst is contaminated by internal shocks, while the optical emission is coming from this reverse shock. We can also calculate the evolution of the original ejecta. This is what you have asked before. Assuming that this is short, there is no long tail like that. There is a reversal going here, and then it swept up the ejecta, and then the ejecta just lags behind the major part of the shocked interstellar medium, and it's expanding adiabatically and cooling. And you can drive the relativistic scaling of that, and you can get that the optical emission from that should decay like t to the minus something around 2.
Do you expect to be rapidly variable if you know, perhaps you got another one?
No.
You think optical emission should be quite smooth?
Yeah. Everything that has to do with the interstellar medium, I suspect, will be smooth.
This is a reverse shock?
Yeah, even so. But it is derived by the interstellar medium. Yeah, well, actually, there are two regimes. Depending if the shares inside here have enough time to do all the relaxation that they need, which is the assumption I'm making here. Under this assumption, then it should be smooth.
But the gamma rays are going to vary.
Right, but the gamma ray happens a lot earlier in the physical space, at much lower radius, where all these cells collided. That's all over. And then the reversal is sweeping all that after all the collision has been done.
Okay, so
could you show again this view graph with the gamma rays and the optical arm that you had before?
There was one with the time variation of the gamma ray and the optical. I think you know what.
I plotted the other thing. This one?
No, you had one.
It was the data, I think.
It's the data.
He wants to see
the data.
Oh, thank you.
Where you showed.
Yeah, the data, okay. This one.
There are three sort of short drop intervals.
Right.
And what's the time scales?
This is seconds with very convenient numbers in here. This is 20 seconds after the burst, initial burst, and this is something like 20 seconds, and this is another 20
seconds. That's the X-rays.
These are gamma rays and X-rays, right? These are, you see the energy in here.
So the X-rays, I guess the X-rays rapidly vary.
Right. Well, smoother than the GLB, especially in this part. So this late thing,
Where's the GLB on that? Sorry, it's over to the left, is it?
This one, yeah. So GLB, here it's also gamma rays.
Sorry, where's the GLB that triggered this? Where?
It began here.
It's about there. So here.
This is the triggering.
That's the trigger.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm just wondering why the optical isn't rapidly, isn't also going to be expected to be varying.
Yeah, because the way we model it, which is, you can doubt that, it's not so strong. But there are internal shocks producing the gamma ray. This lasts something like about 50 seconds. And then on a time scale also 50 seconds, there is a rise of the external shock, both reverse and forward shock. So this should peak around 50 seconds, while this has also emission before 50 seconds. So the optical observation should do this, this, and that, which they do, while the GLB can be variable and peaks over here. Okay? So this is the peak of the GLB, but the peak of the optical is in here. Not in here. And you have only three measurements, so you cannot say if it's variable or not.
It's a predictive future, that's all.
Right. It's going up very strongly in here and decays quite smoothly, like this is minus 2 from here on.
Okay. Right, but
and it's uncorrelated with this variability.
Well, that's the prediction. I think that's very well appreciated. It seems to me that's a very strong prediction if Roxy sees another one.
Right.
And you get actually, sample observation.
Actually, Roxy have better sample of this. They have another observation in here, another observation in here, and another observation even before that. But the software that analyzed all that is written in C, and the pointers were lost. The software pointer to the frame that has this data. We just lost. So they had the data, but not anymore.
Okay. Well, another data you get is another one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the software problem?
Software problem. They changed the software that analyzes this burst a week before the detection of this one. And they had a bug there that throws out every second frame. Absolutely. Let me skip all that. This is the light curve. Is that in C or?
No,
that's okay. So this is the light curve of another famous disk, which is quite recent, as you can see, which has a nice peak of the minus 0.8 temporal decay early on, and then a break to a much sharper decline, which is T to the minus 2, and the interpretation of that is a jet. This is just this wave. I do have to say that the break seems to be rather sharp than you can expect. But as I said, to make this statement precise, you must do a better calculation than people have done. So in the simplest model, of course, it's a point-like break. In a moderately accurate, it's very smooth, but when you do the full thing, you don't know what will be there. And I can point a few points in the moderately accurate calculation that are susceptible, and are susceptible in doing the burst, the break too smooth. Okay, but so I would say that at this point it seems to be a good thing to assume that it is a jet. From the time that there is a break between this behavior to this behavior, you can find out what was the Lorentz factor. You know what was the Lorentz factor at this time, and you can then know what was the opening angle of the jet. And it comes to be like 0.1 radians, which gives you about a factor of 300 or so less energy that you would understand.
You must know the I didn't understand that argument. How do you estimate
the Lorentz factor at this point?
Yes.
Yeah. You know the energy per sterdian just from the gamma ray burst.
Yes.
That's the energy per sterdian.
Yes.
You do spherical, you assume that that's the
spherical, yes.
Assume spherical. And then you know the Lorentz factor each time. You take your solution.
But the energy per sterdian in the gamma ray burst is not necessarily the same as the energy of the fast wave.
Well, it's we assume that it's comparable.
Oh, you assume it's comparable. Okay, yeah. So related. So what is the isotropic energy?
The isotropic energy in this burst is 10 to the 53.
10 to the 53.
Right. So you put 10 to the 53,
yeah.
To like this 10 to the 53 equal gamma square m proton c square r cube.
Okay, yeah.
And then you calculate gamma as function of R, and it's related to the
observed
time.
So you do then you relate gamma energy, total energy, which is questions that it could be much less.
It could be
much less in principle. Yeah.
Which could be less?
This energy? The gamma energy could be much more than the gamma ray energy.
Right. But it's already how
yes, I understand. Yes.
Yeah. It could be less.
Yeah.
But when you calculate the Lorentz factor from this equation, it's not that sensitive to the energy.
Correct.
So if you have done factor of 10 L in the energy, that's not too bad. So if you're 10,000,
what was it? What was the Lorentz factor at the break?
1/0.18.
0.08.
So it's about 12. I remember this number, but it's just one of the variables. Yeah. So the Lorentz factor was 12 at this time, so if it's 12, the opening angle of the jet is 0.08. Mm-hmm. And if it's 0.08, then the real energy is less than 10 to the 53 by a factor of 0.08 squared. So the real energy in this burst is about 10 to 51 L. And the interesting point to note is that whenever we see something like that, even not exactly that, so we infer that the thing is a jet, we also have a very big isotropic energy. So whenever you have big isotropic energy, you have evidence that this being a jet, so that the total energy comes to be reasonable after all. Reasonable meaning 10 to the 52 and less. So that's a good thing to have. Also, the radio light curve of this burst, though it's not that well sampled and not with that good accuracy because it's in the other side of the world where VLA is not there. So this is done by Australian telescope. and we have this data point. And if it was spherical, we should have expected that to rise like 3 to the half, and you can say that it doesn't do that. What other does do that? And if you take the spreading jet model, you get this kind of like, which is more or less compatible with that. Let me tell you in 5 minutes what I was doing in the 3 weeks I was here. This belt, this same belt that is interpreted as a jet, also had polarization measurement, which was 1.7% plus minus 0.2. And this made some people to go and look for this polarization and see, theoretically, and see what you can expect. So as I showed you, in these nice images, we expect that at least in the optical frequency, most of the emission is coming from a ring. This is this ring. And let's assume that the emission is a jet. This is the jet, the start of a very big sphere, that's a jet. And let's assume that the Lorentz factor is high relative to 1 over the opening angle of the jet. So that gamma theta naught is, at this point, is 4. So this is smaller than this. But as the fireball decelerates, this grows because this is 1 over gamma. And at sufficiently late time, you should see that some of the emission is missing. And this is where this break begins. Then when you wait for a much longer time, both the size of the jet begins to grow, and it grows more or less at the same manner as the opening angle of the viewable surface, so you get something which is again more or less spherical, or ringed around, center around you. The observer in all these figures is in 0, 0. So the line of sight from the source to the observer is going through the middle of this gray ring. Now what do you expect regarding polarization from that? You can expect some polarization. If the magnetic field component behind the shock, which we don't know what they are, but if they are different in the direction parallel to the shock and perpendicular to the shock, you expect from each of these points some strong polarization, depending how different these two components are. And it can be, if you take the conditions to be extreme, it can be as high as 70%, a syncopal radiation. Now, the polarization that you get from each of these points is in different direction. So once you average over the whole ring, you get zero polarization. This is the number in Hill. So this is the ring. From this place, you expect polarization in this direction. From this place, in this direction, here, this is the direction of polarization that you expect. And it can be rotated by 90 degrees if the other component of the magnetic field is bigger. So, but let's assume this configuration. Now, during the transition from spherical-like behavior to a spreading jet, you have times in which you see only part of the ring. So if you don't see this, and you average only on that, you see polarization mostly in this direction, because you have two regions in this direction, only one in this direction. So when this is missing, you see polarization in that direction. When more and more of the ring becomes obscured by the size of the jet, you will see that polarization in this direction. So initially you will see polarization in this direction, then the polarization will change its direction by 90 degrees to this direction. And by calculating this kind of diagram, I get this kind of prediction. And due to the short time, let's focus only on the dashed curve, which shows a polarization going in one direction, getting into 15%, which is an optimistic estimate, I think, 15%, going back to zero, and then rising again, but in a 90 degree direction to the previous one. Rising to something like 10%, decreasing again, and then rising again in the original direction. And this is just the result of the omitting that, making both these, bringing this back, and bringing this back. So I think not many objects do that in not many objects have a polarization going up, down, up again and down, but in a 90 degree direction relative to the previous one, and then again in the original way. So if you see something like that, I think it's a good confirmation of the whole thing. To remind you, they measured 1.7%, which is smaller than everything that I have in here, but I assumed to plot this graph that the polarization from each point is 70%. Can easily be much less than that. It will make this a little bit difficult to measure, but not impossible. Yeah, I think I'll stop there.